I can already start commenting on this logo, which was our old logo. So this film obviously was made a while ago. And this is the first time I'm seeing it in almost 10 years. These were the first shots that we actually shot in the making of the film, and then the first shots, obviously, in the movie. And a lot of people have, you know, when I think back on starting this movie, I remember a lot of people questioning whether or not it made sense for me to be making a movie like this, because my background was, you know, so much in comedy and romantic comedy and satire. And, you know, I've always said that it's important for me to find my way into the film, find where is my connection to this movie. And as you will see, the movie is really about a man who is trapped by his own success and is desperately trying to break out and establish himself in a different way. And I felt very much those feelings when I finished doing All in the Family and was thought of as a situation comedy actor and wanted to become a director. And it was very difficult for me to break that mold, because in those days, people in television were looked down upon, thought of as second-class citizens. And it was very hard to make the move into movies. Now you see a lot of people making that break. But for me, it was very difficult. So this movie is all about a writer who has become very successful doing a certain kind of a novel and wants to break out, and the fear that he has of his fans abandoning him. Now, you see James Caan here, who was, quite frankly, not my first choice for this movie. There were other people that I talked to, Robert Redford and Warren Beatty, and I think I was turned down twice by William Hurt, Richard Dreyfuss. I mean, the list goes on and on. But at the end of the day, you know, when you look at a movie like this and a lot of movies that have become successful, you can't imagine anybody else playing the part. And I think at the end of the day, Jimmy Caan was a great choice because, as you'll see, he plays a lot of this movie trapped in a bed in a room. And Jimmy is known to be a very physical and active person. And I think it, in a way, helped him play the frustration and the pain of having to be confined. Now, this sequence was shot up in the Reno, Tahoe area. And we had to scout this location. And my biggest fear in life is being up on cliffs with a overlooking an edge and not having a way to stop a fall if I was to fall. And when we scouted this location, I remember being terrified beyond belief because we were on these very curvy mountain roads, and I was frightened at all times of exactly what happens to Paul Sheldon in the sequence you're about to see. This sequence here, when the car goes off the cliff, we used 9 cameras. Some of them were buried in what they called IMOs, or, you know, they were remote control cameras that were buried in the snow. We knew that we weren't going to be able to throw a car off a cliff too many times, so we wanted to make sure we got it. And I think, you know, 6 or 7 of the cameras actually functioned, and we had enough to make that sequence work.
Old friend, I was rummaging through a closet and just sitting there.
It's nice, Paul.
Lauren Bacall was, we were very lucky to get her. I got a call from her agent saying, you know, would you consider Lauren Bacall for this part? And I said, are you kidding me? Of course I would. I actually went with her to Armani and picked out her clothes with her. I was so excited to have her in the movie. And what she's wearing now is something that we actually picked out together at Armani's. That briefcase that you see that Paul Sheldon has, we spent days and weeks getting that briefcase just right. I kept sending him back, no, it's got to be rubbed down a little bit more. It's got to be just a little bit more worn, because it actually becomes a little bit of a character. And when he thinks about this briefcase, it flashes him back to where he was in that horrible time.
I have something I want on my tombstone.
Now, this sequence was shot, like I say, in the Reno Tahoe area. It was also shot on a soundstage. We intercut both. This interior stuff here is done on a soundstage, and then some of the wider shots were shot actually on location. And we had snow machines and all those things, those great things. And we were very careful to try to make it look very real, the snow, because many times you look at these sequences that have fake snow and it really does look fake. And this, we used actual shaved ice that we shot out of machines, and it gives a real, very real feel to it. There's that briefcase.
I'm your number one fan. There is nothing to worry about. You're gonna be just fine. I'll take good care of you. I'm your number one fan.
And here we reveal Kathy Bates playing Annie Wilkes for the first time. And William Goldman, actually, when we were working on the first draft of the screenplay, when he agreed to write the screenplay, suggested Kathy Bates for the part of Annie Wilkes. And the minute he said it, I said, you're absolutely right. She's the one to do the part. And she was really our first and only choice, and we were very, very lucky to get her.
Yes, that's right. I'm also a nurse. Here, take these.
One of the interesting things also is that Stephen King, who wrote the book, allowed us to option this book. It hadn't been picked up, which is unusual. Most of Stephen King's books get optioned right away once they're in galleys. But Andy Scheinman, my partner and one of the partners at Castle Rock, was actually, the way this happened, he was in an airport, you know, killing some time, and he went to one of those bookshops, and there was a books, you know, Misery was actually in hardback at the time. Just grabbed it off the shelf because he had nothing to do and read it and said, wow, this thing is a great story. And we checked to see if it was available. We figured it wouldn't be available because, like I say, all his books get optioned. And we found out that nobody had touched it. And Stephen King basically said this was the most personal book for him. It was the most autobiographical in an odd way. Not that these things actually happened to him, but the internal struggle that he goes through all the time in trying to break away from his, you know, what he's become successful at, his genre of horror and supernatural, was a reason why he was very reluctant to give it to anybody, because he was frightened that it wouldn't be done right. And since I had done Stand By Me prior to this, and he was very pleased with that, he agreed to allow us to option it on the provision that I would either produce or direct it, that my name would have to be on the screen. So initially I wasn't planning to direct it, but then when we started working on a screenplay, I got more and more involved and realized that I had more of a connection to it than I realized at first.
Your arm will be fine too. Your shoulder was pretty badly dislocated. It was a little stubborn, but I finally popped it back in. What I'm most proud of is the work I did on those legs. Considering what I had around the house, I don't think there's a doctor who could have done any better.
The trick in any kind of prosthetics or makeup that was done on the legs. Obviously, you see quick glances. You don't want to linger on it. Now, this one lingers a little bit long, but once we get to the feet, you'll see we kind of move off it quickly because it's very hard to make these things look realistic.
Hospital. In the meantime, you've got a lot of recovering to do, and I consider it an honor that you'll do it.
It was important that we calibrate Kathy's performance and make sure that we didn't tip the hand of how horrible she was right at the beginning. And you see in that scene, she's very sweet to him. We wanted to hold back how crazy she was for as long as possible to build attention. Now, here's Richard Farnsworth, and he's recently passed away. But he was a great, great actor. He started out as a stuntman, and for many years, that's what he did. And in the latter part of his career, became a really gifted actor. And he was a pleasure to work with. And one of the great joys that I have in my life is that the hat that he's wearing in that scene and that he's worn in a lot of movies, he actually gave to me. And I cherish that bit of memorabilia.
Misery books. Yeah. I'm sure you know that Paul's been coming to the Silver Creek Lodge for years to finish his books.
I understand you've been up here the last 6 weeks.
Not quite. I just called there, and they said he checked out last Tuesday. Isn't that a little strange?
Oh, I don't know. Does he usually phone you before he checks out of a hotel?
No, of course not. It's just that his daughter hasn't heard from him, and when he has a new book coming out, he usually keeps in touch. From him,
You think he might be missing, huh?
I hate that I made this call. Tell me I'm being silly.
Oh, a little overprotective, maybe, but tell you what I'll do. Nothing.
And there's Frances Sternhagen, who's also a wonderful actress. And we had a great relationship, the two of them. Now, this little moment, he says, I'll run it through my system, and he puts a little note on a bulletin board that's crowded with notes. We had little touches like that all throughout the movie, and we wanted to make sure that there was some humor in this thing because it does get kind of tense and gruesome at times, and we wanted to be able to cut that with some comedy. And the relationship between Richard and Francis in this affords us a lot of that those opportunities.
I guess it was kind of a miracle you finding me.
A little foreshadowing here with a razor to his neck.
Not at all. In a way, I was following you.
You were following me?
Well, it wasn't any secret to me you were staying at the Silver Creek, seeing as how I'm your number one fan and all. Some nights I just stool on down there and sit outside and look up at the light in your cabin. And
it was also important for us to make Annie Wilkes a very specifically sick person, not an all-purpose monster. So we spent a lot of time, Kathy and I, really going through her history and her background. Not that we get into it too specifically in the film, but at least she had it in her head who she was, where she came from, what were her influences, and what were the causes of her terrible, terrible dysfunction. And we allude to it later on in the film when we see Paul Sheldon leaf through a scrapbook. But that was a lot of background work that we did to make sure that her monstrousness was specific.
And you're very brilliant. Like a baby. All done.
Thank you. When do you think the phone lines will be up? I have to call my daughter, and I'd like to call my agent in New York and let her know I'm still breathing.
Shouldn't be too much longer now. Once the roads are open, the phone lines will be up in no time. If you give me their numbers, I'll keep trying them for you.
Thank you.
Could I ask you a favor? I noticed in your case there's a new Paul Sheldon book, and I wondered if maybe...
You want to read it?
Well, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I do have a very hard and fast rule as to who reads my stuff at this early stage. Only my editor, my agent, and anybody that saves me from freezing to death in a car wreck.
Oh, you'll never realize what a rare treat you've given me. Boy, it's like clockwork the way your pain comes. I'll get you your novel, Paul. Forgive me for prattling away and making you feel all oogie.
Those phrases like oogie, and when he says, she says later on, he never got out of the cock-a-doodle car, and those Mr. Man, those are all Stephen King phrases, and they're wonderfully whimsical.
I know it sounds crazy, but I haven't written anything but misery for so long. Why don't you read it? And you can tell me what you think it's about. Maybe you can come up with a title.
Like, I could do that.
Jimmy Kahn was in bed for a big portion of the movie, and every day he'd come to the set, and I'd say to him, Jimmy, today you're going to be in bed. I'd say that every day to them to try to lighten the tension, because it was so frustrating for him to be in bed every day.
Federal Express packages, anything out of the ordinary?
I don't think Mr. Sheldon likes for things to be out of the ordinary. Considering who he is and all famous and all, he doesn't...
We shot this scene actually up in an abandoned lodge in Lake Tahoe.
65 Mustang, says it helps him to think. He's always been a good guest. Mm-hmm. Never makes a noise, never bothers a soul. I sure hope nothing's happened to him.
So do I.
I bet that old Mustang is pulling into New York right now.
I'm sure you're right. Thanks, Libby.
My pleasure.
Now, this scene is the first little tip of the iceberg where you start to see the cracks in Annie Wilkes's character. Well, like I say, we tried to dole it out a little bit at a time and hold back how nightmarish she is for as long as we could.
What is it?
It's ridiculous. Who am I to make a criticism to someone like you?
It's all right. I can take it.
Well, it's brilliantly written, but then everything you write is brilliant.
Pretty rough stuff.
The swearing, Paul. There, I said it.
The profanity bothers you.
It has no nobility.
These are slum kids. I was a slum kid. Everybody talks like that.
They do not! What do you think I say when I go to the feed store in town? Oh, now, Wally, give me a bag of that effing pig feed and 10 pounds of that bitchly cow corn. And in the bank, do I tell Mrs. Bollinger, oh, here's one big bastard of a check. Give me some of your Christing money. There, look there. See what you made me do? Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, sometimes I get so worked up. Can you ever forgive me?
Fine.
I love you, Paul. Your mind, your creativity. That's all I meant.
These two actors really, I think, are what makes this movie as powerful as it is, because you have two really great actors creating a reality here that makes the horror that much more horrible. When people talk about this movie, they always talk about the scene where the guy breaks she breaks the ankle. And there's not a lot of horror in this movie. There are not a lot of horrific scenes. There's only a couple. But they become that much more horrific because the audience feels that it's being done to a real person, and a real person is feeling that. And that's what makes it so, so horrific. And I think that's a testament to how good Kathy Bates and Jimmy Kahn are in this movie. Now, I know Kathy won an Oscar for it, and she deserved it, but Jimmy is equally as brilliant and has, plays with his reactions, which speak volumes. Now, here again, we have this wonderful little relationship between Richard and Francis, and it kind of just, like I say, cuts the tension a little bit. And then we bring it back in again.
See that broken limb?
Could have been the weight of the snow.
Yeah, could have been a rotten branch. Could have been the wind. Could have been a lot of things.
We also tried to make Buster's character a little bit more proactive than he was in the book, so that he is really actively trying to figure out what happened to Paul Sheldon. And we give him some real deductive reasoning and logic. We give him some a real thought process to try to figure out the disappearance of Paul Sheldon.
Need some help? No, I'm enjoying myself. Thank you.
And then this little reveal. He came so close, but we hold it off just a little longer, and this hopefully builds attention for the audience.
Do you think Sheldon's out there?
I hope not. If he is, he's dead. Let's go to the newspaper office.
This shot was designed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who was the director of photography on the film. And it's great because the camera just, with one shot, leaves them and reveals Annie. And I think it's a brilliant shot. I never would have figured it because I don't think that way. And Barry is was a brilliant cinematographer. Now he's a brilliant director. And he has a great sense of how to use the camera. And you can see it here. I worked with him on When Harry Met Sally. And this film, he was unbelievably valuable to me.
Look what I got. They had it at the store, Paul. There was a whole batch of them there. And as soon as I saw it, I slammed my money down. I got the first copy.
And the roads are open.
Well, the one to town is, but that's about it.
Now, it was very important to us to create the reality that there was no way that Paul Sheldon could get out of this house if Annie Wilkes was a benign person. In other words, if she was not trapping him here, there would be no physical way to get him out of there. And in all honesty, I have to credit Warren Beatty for helping us close some of the holes in the plot here, in that he was involved at one point when we were developing the script, and he kept saying, you know, if I, you know, pretend that it's me, Warren Beatty, an intelligent person trapped in a bed, I would think of every possible way to get out of this house, a helicopter, a way into town, somehow to be moved. And we created all of the obstacles that I think are, I think this, you know, this film, and I'm quite proud of the fact that it is hole free. It doesn't have any plot holes. And that, I think, is in large part due to Warren Beatty's persistence.
And I'm on page 75.
I guess that means it's okay.
No. No, it isn't. It's... Oh, poo.
The other way that Barry Sonnenfeld was so valuable to me is that literally 75% of this movie takes place in one room. So we were constantly trying to find new angles and new lighting schemes and designs and ways of shooting it that would make it interesting and not claustrophobic. I mean, you know, it has to be claustrophobic for the actors, and the audience has to feel that, but we can't make the audience feel claustrophobic. So Barry was very inventive in figuring out different angles and different lighting schemes, and I think it makes the picture, you know, as expansive as it is, even though it is claustrophobic. Now, this was shot actually on location. We built a little piece of the house on location where you can actually look out the window. But then this shot, and now we're back into on the stage, and we're using a backdrop, what they called a trans light, which is a picture of the outdoors in which you direct light through to make it look like it's really there. But we did a couple of shots of the actual location that the house was in, and now this stuff, like I say, is all with the backdrop is a trans light.
Misery.
Yes, I told you I was your number one fan.
And here again, we use this pig to kind of cut the tension a little bit.
Very well, with just a few cows and chickens in me, but when I got Misery here, everything changed. She just makes me smile, so.
She's a fine pig is what she is.
I'm on page 300 now, Paul. And it's better than perfect. It's divine. What's the ceiling that Dago painted?
The Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, that and Misery's Child. Those are the only two divine things ever in this world. When my husband left me, I wasn't prepared. It wasn't an easy time. For a while, I thought I might go crazy.
Yeah, I know how that can be.
I don't know about you, but what I did to get through it was I dove into work. Days, nights. Night shifts can be lonely at a hospital. I did a lot of reading. That was when I first discovered Misery. She made me so happy. She made me forget all my problems. Of course, I suppose you had a little something to do with that, too.
Yeah, well.
I just kept reading them over and over. I've only got two chapters to go on this one, and I know when I finish, I'll just turn right to the first page and start reading it all over again.
Done? Yeah.
No problem.
Thanks.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not against marriage per se, but it'd take a pretty special guy to make me want to walk down that aisle again.
Yeah, it's not something you should enter into lightly.
It boils down to respect.
I love this, that he's just shaking this bottle of urim in front of him. It's just so weird and nutty, and the situation that he's in and what we know is about to come, and this thing that seems so normal and so everyday, and just that combination of things is just great. And here's, you can see this translate back. We had two different translates. We had a day, an overcast one and a sunny one. Barry made the most out of both of them. And now here we are. I don't know how many minutes we are into the movie, but this is the first time we really see how crazy and sick this woman is.
She can't be dead. Misery Chastain cannot be dead.
Annie, in 1871, women often died in childbirth. But her spirit is the important thing, and Misery's spirit is still alive.
I don't want her dead! I want her! And you murdered her!
No! I didn't.
Who did?
No one. She died. She just slipped away.
Slipped away? Slipped away? She didn't just slip away. You did it. 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 You murdered my Misery.
Annie.
I thought you were good, Paul. But you're not good. You're just another lying old dirty birdie. And I don't think I better be around you for a while. And don't even think about anybody coming for you. Not the doctors, not your agent, not your family. Because I never called them. Nobody knows you're here. And you better hope nothing happens to me. Because if I die, you die.
He's not in for a good time now. Again, this is a really beautiful shot here that Barry created using the lace as a diffusion for the light. And this was shot on actual location. One of the interesting things in working with James Caan and Kathy Bates is that they both have very different methods of working. I mean, Kathy is a stage-trained actress, and she loves lots and lots and lots of rehearsal. Jimmy is a very instinctive actor and very naturalistic, and he likes to just get out there and do it and not, you know, over-rehearse. He feels it's going to get stale for him. So we had to find a way to probably rehearse a lot less than Kathy wanted to and a lot more than Jimmy wanted to, but it worked out in the end. Now, in preparing for this movie, because even though it's a theme that I can connect with, the idea of breaking away from people's preconceived ideas of how you function as an artist, I certainly was not schooled in the art of making thrillers, and I watched every single Alfred Hitchcock film ever made to really understand the grammar of the thriller. And a lot of these shots where you see the camera moving in on a doorknob and the low angles and the lots of inserts for doorknobs turning and bobby pins on the floor and those kinds of things. These are things that, you know, anybody who makes a lot of thrillers knows about, but I certainly was not familiar with, and I had to go to school and learn these things.
No, Miss Sindel, there's no point in coming up here now. Everything that can be done is. Yes, we're working close with the state police, and the FBI's been informed. Right. Right. As soon as we know anything, we'll let you know. No bother at all. Call any time. Goodbye, Miss Sindel.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate it. Thank you.
Miss Sindel was my agent at the time, Jane Sindel. That's where we got that name.
And no calls about the article either.
You poor dear thing. What are you doing on the floor? It's all my fault. If I'd had a proper hospital bed, this never would have happened. Here, let me help you back in.
Oh.
I know this hurts. It'll only take a few seconds. Up! Daisy!
Ow!
Oh.
Oh, please. Wait.
Oh, you're such a crybaby.
Wait.
There you go. Comfy?
Perfect.
Such a kidder. I have a big surprise for you. But first, there's something you must do.
You don't suppose I could have a little snack while I'm waiting for the surprise?
I'll get you everything you want, but you must listen first. Sometimes my thinking is a little muddy. I accept that. That's why I couldn't remember all the things they were asking me on the witness stand in Denver. But this time I thought clearly. I asked God about you, and God said, I delivered him unto you so that you may show him the way.
We slipped these little things like the witness stand in Denver when she went through her divorce. I mean, these are little windows into her character, and we try to just dribble it out so that it piques the audience's interest. We had to create a believable reason for why he would only have one copy of this book, and I think we came up with a pretty good solution. It was not in the book, Misery, but we came up with this.
I know this may be difficult for you, but it's for the best.
It's really not difficult at all. My agent made dozens of copies. There's going to be an auction in New York. Every publishing house in New York is reading it now. So if you want me to burn my book, fine. You're not really ridding the world of anything.
Then light the match, Paul.
It's no big deal.
So you've indicated. Do it.
I know this is the only copy, Paul. When you were 24, you wrote your first book and you didn't make a copy because you didn't think anybody would take it seriously. But they did, and ever since, you've never made any copies because you're superstitious. That's why you always come back to the Silver Creek Lodge. You told that story to Merv Griffin 11 years ago.
Now, the fact that he also works on a manual typewriter, I think, is also interesting. Bill Goldman used to, I don't know that to this day that he does. He might have a word processor by now, but Bill Goldman used to work on a manual typewriter for years. And I kind of like that about this guy's character, that he's superstitious about the success of his first book and that he continued to write in the same method.
Match Paul. Can't you see it's what God wants? You're so brilliant, I would think you'd certainly be able to see that. We're put on this earth to help people, Paul. Like I'm trying to help you. Please, help me help you.
Now he knows how crazy this woman is. So when she starts flipping that lighter fluid on him, he knows that she is totally capable of burning him in that bed alive, and that would be the only thing that would motivate him to burn his own book.
You're doing the right thing. Oh, my goodness! Goodness gracious! Oh, my. Oh, goodness.
Now, those little pieces of paper flying up in the air, you know, some of them did it on their own, but I remember this was such a weird thing. We had grips with fishing poles with monofilament pulling little shard pieces of paper up in the air to make it look like the manuscript was floating into the air. It's one of those weird things in movies where you step back for a second and go, look what I'm doing here. There's men with fishing poles pulling paper up into the air. Now here we are in the soundstage. But then we go obviously outside to see this helicopter, and then I think it's very well done where we marry shooting on the actual location and the soundstage.
That's no 65 Mustang. Well, there's nothing else out this way. Let's circle back.
There's the shot. It's right, and that happened on the actual location right there. And everything else other than that shot was shot on a soundstage in this sequence.
I do believe the winters are getting shorter and shorter every year. People say it has something to do with the ozone layer. What do you think?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's a theory. Here's your novel.
Has the first thought of trying to figure out some way to get himself out of this situation. That was that first thought when he looked at those pills.
They chose Kevin.
Yeah. He's backstage. Say hello to Kevin Andrews. Hi, Kevin. Hi, how you doing, Chuck? Fine. Make yourself at home back there.
Hi, Sherry.
Cherie, tell us about the date.
Okay. First of all, I picked out a very classy restaurant. It was so classy. And he shows up without no tie.
Thank you. And these were kinds of things that we tried to we added from the book, the idea of this cat and mouse game between the two of them. There were a lot more horrific things in the novel than there are in the movie, and I felt that it would be more interesting if this were a real psychological chess game between these two people, and it's something that I felt was a little bit more realistic. I tried to make it as natural and realistic as possible and say what would actually happen if somebody were stuck in a situation like this, because ultimately she is madly in love with him in a very sick and twisted way, obviously. And so he's trying to think, well, what can I do to play on that love that she has for me? How can I use this in a almost like a jiu-jitsu to turn it around against her? And that's the plan that he has hatched, or at least the beginnings of it, when he starts hiding the painkillers.
Misery's return.
I know you didn't mean it when you killed her, and now you'll make it right. It'll be a book in my honor for saving your life and nursing you back to health. Oh, Paul, you're going to make me the envy of the whole world.
You just expect me to whip something off, is that it?
I expect nothing less than your masterpiece.
You do understand that this is not the ordinary way in which books get written. I mean, some people might actually consider this an oddball situation.
I have total confidence in your brilliance. Besides, the view will inspire you. You just inhale that. I'll be right back.
I guess you don't get bothered by neighbors much.
Don't you worry about that. You'll have total solitude so you can concentrate on your work.
Great.
I got you this expensive paper to type on. And I got a great deal on this 50-pound clunker on account of its missing an N. I told the sales lady N was one of the letters in my favorite writer's name.
It's two of the letters in my favorite nurse's name, Annie.
You fooler. Did I do good?
You did great. There is just one little thing. I can't work on this paper. See, it's graspable bond and it smudges. So I thought maybe if you went back into town, you could bring me some white long-grain Mimeo.
But mine costs the most. So I don't see how it can smudge.
Come here, I'll show you.
We have a person who's a writer who has intelligence, and we wanted to utilize his intelligence in any way to save himself. So when he sees that bobby pin, he comes up with this idea about the crassable bond. I think it made it more, like I say, a more interesting kind of psychological chess game between these two.
The finished book, but how it's written.
Thank you for thinking of me. Anything else I can get while I'm in town? Any other crucial requirements that need satisfying? Would you like a tiny tape recorder? Or how about a handmade set of writing slippers?
Well, just the paper will be fine.
Are you sure? Because if you want, I'll bring back the whole store for you.
Annie, what's the matter?
What's the matter? I'll tell you what's the matter. I go out of my way for you. I do everything to try and make you happy. I feed you, I clean you, I dress you, and what thanks do I get? Oh, you bought the wrong paper, Annie. I can't write on this paper, Annie. Well, I'll get your stupid paper, but you just better start showing me a little more appreciation around here, Mr. Man. Ah!
And just a little reminder of what he's up against and why he so desperately needs to get out of this situation.
Yeah.
This whole next sequence is all about tension and building tension. And the question is he going to be able to even pick up the bobby pin? Once he picks up the bobby pin, will he be able to unlock the door? Once he unlocks the door, is he going to be able to get in touch with anybody before she returns from the store? So the whole idea here is to build tension as best we can. And I think this is one of my favorite sequences in the whole movie because, without doing anything nightmarish or horrible, I think, get the audience pretty worked up.
Shit.
And it's all about orchestrating the tension, too, because you can't start it too soon. You have to build it. And this is a fairly long sequence. And so you have to be very judicious about how you build one piece of tension on the next. Now, I remember when he opens this door and he wheels himself out into the hallway, we as a crew and as the makers of the movie were like ecstatic because we had spent literally 6, 7, or 8 weeks inside this bedroom, and we were just dying to shoot anything but the bedroom. So when we got out into the hall, we went, yay, we're in the hallway. Now, we had literally only moved like 4 feet, but it was so exciting to be shooting something other than that bedroom.
What a surprise.
Now, what's coming up is what I feel is the only slight cheat in the entire movie, and that is when we reveal the phone and he gets his hopes up that he's going to actually be able to reach the outside world, and then you discover, as he does right here, that the phone is dysfunctional and there are no works in it. And the question was always, well, we're really cheating the audience, because why would there be a phone there if it didn't, you know, if it didn't have any works in it? And we rationalized it by saying, well, Annie Wilkes is crazy and, you know, she might be just crazy enough to have some wacky thing like a phone, you know, an old-fashioned phone like this just sitting around. But in reality, it's, you know, to be honest, it's a moment that just we want to just torture the audience a little bit there. But it's the only time in the whole movie that I think we have that kind of manipulative thing that isn't, you know, totally 100% earned. And now we start this this slow race to who's gonna win here? Is he gonna get back to the room in time, or is she gonna discover him? And this is a nice little moment here. We found these little things where we play back later the fact that he puts the penguin back in the opposite direction. At the time, I don't think anybody thinks anything of it, but we certainly make good on it later on. And then, of course, this shrine to Liberace here, and then the other one to Paul Sheldon, which he comes upon. That's my handwriting right there. So if anybody ever gets an autograph from me, you'll see that same kind of handwriting. Here's where Mark Shaiman did a great job. Now, again, Mark Shaiman was not known to doing these kinds of thriller-type pictures. He had done mostly comedy and musical-type things. But he is so brilliant and he is so versatile that I said, you know, Mark, do you think you can do this? He said, absolutely. And here you have this incredibly tense score that he created. And this is an amazingly versatile composer who, you know, did the scores for not only this, but Few Good Men and American President and When Harry Met Sally. So he's an amazing composer. And now we build, and we build this slowly, and the music helps us here in building the tension.
Oh,
kind you ask for. Paul, you're dripping with perspiration. Your color is very hectic. What have you been doing?
You know damn well what I've been doing. I've been sitting here suffering. I need my pills.
Poor dear. Let's get you back in bed and I'll get them for you.
I want my pills now.
It'll only take a second.
No! I want my pain to go away, Annie. Please, make it go away. Please, Annie. Please.
It just breaks my heart to see you like this. I've done a lot of thinking on the drive. Here you go. And I'm absolutely certain the main reason I've never been more popular is because of my temper. You must be so mad at me. The truth now.
Well, who doesn't let off a little steam every once in a while?
My genius needs his rest before he writes. Gypsy's up. There you go. Okay. Here. In case you think of any ideas.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't expect too much.
Don't be silly. You'll be brilliant. Think of me as your inspiration. I have faith in you, my darling. Catch this. Mwah!
Again, we have to keep the search alive. And there wasn't a lot to go on, so we had to really kind of, like I say, judiciously plot out the discovery and the trail of Paul Sheldon. Here's J.T. Walsh, who's a great actor, and I was very fortunate to, just said, okay, I'll do this for you, and he came up and did it.
Area hospital. Undoubtedly, he is buried somewhere out there in the snow. We'll find him after the first thaw. That is, unless the animals didn't get to him first, which is a distinct possibility.
That was a statement from Colorado Police Chief Sherman Douglas.
Novelist Paul
we will be updating you with.
You don't think he's dead, do you?
Well, he might well be, but not the way they say. He never crawled out of that car by himself. You see the dents on the door there? Someone pulled him out.
Shot through the bed to make him look like he's in jail were very conscious things that we did.
sorry, Paul. This is all wrong.
What?
You'll have to do it over again. It's not worthy of you. Throw it all out. Except for that part of naming the gravedigger after me. You can leave that in.
I really value your criticism, but maybe we're being a little hasty here.
Paul, what you've written just isn't fair.
Not fair.
That's right. When I was growing up in Bakersfield, my favorite thing in all the world was to go to the movies on Saturday afternoons for the chapter plays.
Cliffhangers.
I know that, Mr. Man. They also call them serials. I'm not stupid, you know. Anyway, my favorite was Rocket Man. And once it was a no-breaks chapter. And the bad guy stuck him in a car on a mountain road and knocked him out and welded the door shut and tore out the brakes and started him to his death. And he woke up and tried to steer and tried to get out, but the car went off a cliff before he could escape. And it crashed and burned, and I was so upset and excited. And the next week, you better believe I was first in line. And they always start with the end of the last week. And there was Rocket Man trying to get out. And here comes the cliff. And just before the car went off the cliff, he jumped free. And all the kids cheered. But I didn't cheer. I stood right up and started shouting, "This isn't what happened last week! Have you all got amnesia? They just cheated us! This isn't fair! He didn't get out of the cock-a-doodle car!"
Now, I love that speech because it's so wacky and nutty, but also because what she's saying is right. You know, and we took that to heart when we were making this movie, which is not to cheat the audience. I mean, to me, I sit in a movie theater. I want the filmmaker to, you know, to plug up all the holes and to dot the I's and cross the T's so that when I'm, you know, it doesn't insult my intelligence. And we tried to do that with this movie. I don't know if we succeeded, but we didn't. I don't think we really cheated the audience where they would ever at any point go, "Oh, that couldn't happen," you know, or "This is impossible." We tried to make it as believable and realistic as possible.
Is it fair? Should I continue?
You better. Oh, Paul. When Ian realized that the reason they'd buried Misery alive was because the bee sting had put her in that temporary coma. And when Gravedigger Wilkes remembered how 30 years earlier the same thing had happened to Lady Evelyn Hyde. Oh, and then old Dr. Cleary deduced that Misery must be Lady Evelyn Hyde's long-lost daughter because of the rarity of deadly bee stings, my heart just leapt! I've known from the very first book that Misery had to be born of nobility, and I was right.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul, can I read each chapter when you finish? I can fill in the ends. Will she be her old self now that Ian has dug her out, or will she have amnesia?
I have to wait.
Will she still love him with that special, perfect love?
You'll have to wait.
Not even a hint?
Mm-mm.
Oh, Misery's alive! Misery's alive! Oh, it's so romantic! Oh, this whole house is going to be filled with romance. I'm going to put on my Liberace records.
Now, that's a little moment there where she wants to know what's going to happen next. And he doesn't tell her. And there was a thing in this, in the novel called the gotta, which Stephen King refers to as the gotta. And that is, I gotta find out what happens. Is you can leave the reader with the desire to really want to know what's going to happen next. Then you've hooked them. It's like, I've got to finish this chapter. I've got to find out what happens at the end of the book. And so hopefully he's luring her in with the book, but at the same time he's seducing her in service of this grand plan that he has to try to escape.
No, he's not here. I don't know where he is. He never tells me anything anymore. He's probably out having an affair somewhere. Wait a minute. He's coming in now. It's Jim Taylor. He wants to know who you're having an affair with.
Oh, Jim. It's you. Uh-huh. Jim, we've been through this before. If you're going to have benches out in front of your store, people are going to want to sit on them. Well, I don't like him either, but I'm not going to come over there and tell him to move.
I love this little moment because while this man is trying to find out the whereabouts of a disappearing and possibly dead person. He's also have to deal with the issues of a small town, which is a man is worried about some guy he doesn't like sitting in front of his store.
Fine, Paul Sheldon. At least I can find out what he wrote about.
What do you expect to find? A story about a guy who drove his car off a cliff in a snowstorm?
You see, it's just that kind of sarcasm that's given our marriage real spice.
And again, we had to manufacture a lot of the clues and things that Buster would dig out, because there isn't much to go on. So he's now just trying to steep himself in Paul Sheldon to find if there's anything he can figure out how, you know, to lead to his whereabouts. This is one of my favorite scenes.
Never had meatloaf this good. What do you do to it?
My secret is I only use fresh tomatoes, never canned. And to give it that little extra zip, I mix in some Spam with the ground beef.
Ah.
Can't get this in a restaurant in New York.
Let's have a toast.
A toast?
Yes, to misery. Let me pour you some wine.
No. Kathy is so great in this scene. I mean, she's just so much in love, and she's so demure in this part of her character, which is just so such the antithesis to this crazy, insane soul that's blended in with this kind of sweet, innocent quality.
I don't know. I think so. I'll go look.
Did you study decorating, or do you just have a flair?
Oh, you. I just pick things up over the years.
Well, certainly says you.
You really think so?
Oh, absolutely. Listen, if you can't find any, it's okay. I just thought it'd be nice.
Are you kidding? If anyone had ever told me that one day I'd be having a candlelit dinner with Paul Sheldon in my own house, I would have checked both legs to see which one was being pulled. Will this do?
It's perfect. To Misery and to Annie Wilkes, who brought her back to life.
Oh, Paul, I get goosebumps every time I think about it. Oh, my God, what have I done? Oh, I'm so sorry, Paul. I ruined your beautiful toast. Oh. Will you ever forgive me? Here, let me pour another one.
The look on Jimmy's face in this scene is just priceless. I mean, all that work, all of that, the hiding of the pills, the concocting the plan, the putting the pills in the paper and everything, and it all just disappears at this moment, and he's back to square one. And I just love this scene, and we've now dug him in an even deeper hole, and so how is he going to get out? This is a sequence that Barry Sonnenfeld and I created together. The idea was to show a passage of time with essentially what looks like one shot, which is the camera, I mean, moving around the room, but we intersperse, Annie reading and him typing and Buster doing his investigative work, but then all along, you know, we've got Liberace playing in the background. So, and we see the change in the translight and the snow. And I think this sequence is really effective and it works really well. We just put the camera on a track and moved it around the room and kept changing the backdrops and the lighting and his clothes. And it's not something we storyboarded. It's something we just had in our heads how we were going to do it.
Here's your pills.
Annie? Annie, what is it?
The rain. Sometimes it gives me the blues. When you first came here, I only loved the writer part of Paul Sheldon. But now I know I love the rest of him, too. I know you don't love me. Don't say you do. You're a beautiful, brilliant, famous man of the world, and I'm not a movie star type. You'll never know the fear of losing someone like you if you're someone like me.
Why would you lose me?
Book's almost finished. Your legs are getting better. Soon you'll be wanting to leave.
Why would I leave? I like it here.
That's very kind of you. But I'll bet it's not altogether true. This gun. Sometimes I think about using it. I better go now. I might put bullets in it.
Now we up the stakes again. And again, Jimmy's performance is so good, and it's what makes us work, because we are putting ourselves, we the audience, are in Jimmy's position here and wondering what we would do if we were stuck in the same situation.
Higher than that of man, I will be judged by him.
What?
They're hauling Misery into court.
That's nice.
There is a justice higher than that of man. I will be judged by him.
Here's where we reveal the final piece of the puzzle to Annie Wilkes' character. And what we learn about her is something that was loosely based on a real person who was arrested in, I believe it was Texas. It was a nurse who was charged and convicted, I believe, of killing a number of children. she would inject them with some serum that would put them in convulsions and then try to revive them and act as if she was the one who was going to save their lives. And she would actually wind up going to the funerals of many of these children that she worked with. And she worked in a couple of hospitals, and I think then she worked in a pediatrician's office. And so this character, I believe, was that Stephen King was loosely based on this real person that existed. And now we reveal all these babies that were dying in the hospital. Here we build the tension for this expected confrontation, and then again we deflate it. This is a real Barry Sonnenfeld type shot, that overhead kind of shot. That which we don't know quite what that is, we will pay that off and find out what that was all about.
I'm supposed to lead into the finale of my show right now, but I'm having such a wonderful time and I have no other
Paul.
So if you'd like me to stay and play some more for you, I'd love to.
I know you've been out.
What?
You've been out of your room.
No, I haven't.
Paul, my little ceramic penguin in the study always faces due south.
I don't know what you're talking about. Ceramic penguin.
Is this what you're looking for?
The knife, as we refer to in the horror genre, as the classic.
I couldn't figure out how
how you did it. But last night, I found your key. I know I left my scrapbook out. I can imagine what you might be thinking of me. But you see, Paul, it's all...
Now, coming up is, you know, considered by a lot of people the most... It's obviously the most gruesome scene in this movie, but a lot of people think it's the most gruesome scene in any movie. And it's certainly the one that's talked about most when people think about Misery. And in the book, Stephen King actually has Annie Wilkes chopping off Paul Sheldon's foot. And we felt that to do that, it wasn't a question of what that it was more horrible or less horrible. The question is, we wanted Paul Sheldon to, at the end of this movie, to emerge victorious over Annie Wilkes. And if he wound up without a foot, even if he winds up beating her and she dies, then, you know, he maybe pay too high a price for that. And the question is, what price do you pay in order to change your way in creating art? I mean, how much pain do you have to go through in order to go away from what has been successful for you and forge a new path? So we felt that this was certainly painful enough, and most of the people who've seen this movie say it was pretty darn painful to look at, so I don't think we compromised it too much. This little moment we placed here just to make it believable that Buster's memory might be jogged about the quote that he read in the book and his ability to match it up to something that he had remembered reading in a newspaper. And so we needed this little moment here to, like I say, jog his memory.
Just leave it, all right?
Oh, I like that tone.
How many times do I have to tell you? I have a system here. What the hell is that thing?
What thing?
The thing. There it is, right where it's supposed to be.
What is it?
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe nothing.
Well, I'm glad you found it.
There's that spice again.
Such a kidder. Come on, Misery. Come on, Misery.
And now we start the chase with Buster. And whether is he going to get to Paul in time?
Do you have any new Paul Sheldon books?
Well, we had a batch. Sold them all out in 3 days.
You wouldn't happen to know if Miss Wilkes bought one of them, would you?
You kidding? Every time that fella writes a new book, she has me set aside the first copy.
Has she been buying anything odd lately?
Miss Wilkes? Same old stuff. lest you call paper on.
Newspaper?
No. Typing kind.
Well, that kind. Nothing odd about that.
Miss Wilkes done something?
Not a thing.
Now, this convention that we're about to see is something that Stephen King has used before, and it actually is used in The Shining, which is, if you recall, the Scatman Crothers character is alerted to the fact that something might be going up on the, you know, going on in the lodge where Nicholson is terrorizing his family, and Scatman Crothers comes back and tries to save things, and then, of course, we know what happens to him. And this is a similar kind of convention, but it works well here as well. And in the convention of this cat and mouse game between Paul Sheldon and Annie Wilkes, it would only be fitting that it would come down to mano a womano, as it were, and not have him be saved by the sheriff, although we try to create, the tension of whether or not the sheriff is going to be able to discover Paul Sheldon and save him. Now, this was shot on the soundstage, the scene here between the two of them. And we have the translite again back there. And the translites are, like I say, they're backdrops with lights. It's actually a photograph with lights behind them to make them look realistic. And it is so realistic here that we actually shot into the translite a couple of times without anything in front of it. And it was so believable that nobody could see it.
He's been missing for quite some time now, and
it's so upsetting. I'm his number one fan. I've got all his books, every sentence he ever put down. I'm so proud of my Paul Sheldon collection. Well, here I am, prattling on, and my manners have just flown away. I haven't invited you in. Please.
Thank you.
Of course, you must know all about that horrible accident.
Mind if I take a look around?
Of course not. That accident almost killed me, too. I prayed when I heard the news. I got down on my knees and I begged for it not to be true. You're gonna laugh at what I'm about to say, but go ahead. I don't care. When I was praying, God told me to get ready.
Get ready for what?
To be his replacement. He gave so much pleasure to so many people. There's a shortage of pleasure on the planet these days, in case you hadn't noticed. God told me, since I was his number one fan, that I should make up new stories as if I was Paul Sheldon. So I went to town, and I bought a typewriter and paper to type on, the same kind Paul Sheldon used. And I turned the guest bedroom into a writing studio. Would you like to see it?
Sure.
It's right this way. I know how he wrote. The kinds of words he used, the wonderful stories he told. I spent the last 4 weeks trying to write like Paul Sheldon, but I can't do it right. I try and I try and I know all the words, but it's just not the same.
Well, maybe it takes a while to get the hang of it.
I could give you a couple of hundred pages of mine and you could tell me what you think.
I'm not much of a critic.
Well, I just thought. Oh, look at me. You'd think I'd never had a guest before. Would you like a nice hot cup of cocoa?
No, really, I don't
care.
It's
no trouble. There's some already made.
Must get lonely living out here all by yourself.
Well, I always say if you can't enjoy your own company, you're not fit company for anyone else.
Well, you've got a point there.
I like that little moment.
Hey,
This shot was just created to build some tension, because you have a sense that something could happen to him when you see this. And
here you are.
Oh, thanks, Miss Wilkes, but I don't want to take up any more of your time. I best be going.
But you didn't even taste your cocoa.
Well, I'm sure it's wonderful, but I really should be getting back. Well, if you wouldn't mind, perhaps I could pay you another visit sometime.
I'd be delighted, now that you know the way.
Miss Wilkes, are you all right?
Here! I'm down here! Down here!
Mr. Sheldon?
Don't feel bad, Paul. It was bound to happen sooner or later. It's a sign. You see, I've known for some time why I was chosen to save you. You and I were meant to be together forever. But now our time in this world must end. But don't worry, Paul. I've prepared for what must be done. I put two bullets in my gun. One for you and one for me. Oh, darling, it'll be so beautiful.
And this is something we created for the, again, for the film, the idea that, you know, a crazy person who wants to murder somebody would be then linked with them for forever. The idea that she would kill both herself and Paul Sheldon, so that she would forever be linked with him in heaven or for posterity. And there's the sick, twisted notion.
You're right.
But then again, he's smarter than she is, so he figures out a way to stall this and then enact a plan of his own.
It must be so that Misery can live. We have the power to give Misery eternal life. We must finish the book.
But the time is now. Soon others will come.
It's almost finished. By dawn, we'll be able to give Misery back to the world.
I'll fix you something to eat.
And I love the idea. This is the first time we noticed, like, you know, that it doesn't have the ends. And I just love that little quirky, weird thing that this typewriter has no ends.
With Ian or Winthorne?
You'll know very soon. I've just started the last chapter. You know, when I finish, I'd like everything to be perfect. I'll need three things.
What things?
You mean you don't know?
I was fooling, silly. You need a cigarette because you used to smoke, but you quit, except when you finish a book. And you have just one. And the match is to light it. And you need one glass of champagne. Dom Perignon.
Dom Perignon it is.
And then this again is so smart of him, because he knows how much of a fan she is, and that she would know exactly the ritual that he went through, that he would go through every time he finishes a book, which we establish at the beginning of the movie.
Annie,
Yes, Paul.
I'm almost done.
Oh, Paul, this is so romantic. Ian and Winthorne dueling for the right to Misery's hand. Does Ian win? Odo, tell me. It's Winthorne, right?
You'll know everything in a minute. Get the champagne.
Oh. Oh. Did I do good?
You did perfect. Except for one thing. This time we'll need two glasses.
Oh, Paul.
And he knew that too. And that's what's so wonderful. He knew he would draw her in because she loves him so much. And then we have this climactic sequence here. And what's interesting is here you have this thriller, which has very little violence. I mean, it has a couple of moments. Obviously, the moment where she breaks his ankles and the moment where Buster gets shot. But aside from that, you have only this real big fight action sequence. And yet, I think the audience is totally hooked in and involved.
Or if they'd ever be reunited, it's all right here. Does she finally marry Ian, or will it be Winthorne? It's all right here.
Paul, you can't!
Why not? I learn it from you.
No, 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 Misery! Not my Misery! No, not my Misery!
One of the few fight sequences I have ever choreographed in my life. I had a duel sequence in Princess Bride and this one, and I got to tell you, I don't enjoy staging fight sequences. This was not a fun thing for me to be doing, but we knew we had to do this in order to have the culmination of this movie be effective, because it ultimately, like I say, it comes down to these two people fighting and clawing for their lives. And he actually uses his broken and twisted leg to trip her, and then she actually gets killed by hitting the typewriter, which I think is kind of appropriate. Or at least we think she's dead. At the time when we did this, I don't think anybody had really done this kind of, I mean, we obviously in some movies they've done where the person comes back, but since this movie it's been used hundreds of times, and it's probably a cliche now that not too many people can get away with anymore. I love the fact that there's this pig, this iron pig doorstop that comes into play here. And again, the fact that she dies lying on top of him with that look in her eyes of like, I love you, how could you do this to me? And it's almost like these two people have just made love. That was the idea, that this fight to the death was like two people who just made love and now we're relaxing after having had this incredible lovemaking session, although it's as violent and horrific as it can be.
it. Very first copy.
And what's interesting is that in the book Misery, Stephen King actually has the character Paul Sheldon fake burning the book of Misery's Return and actually winds up publishing that book. And that, I think, is a very big difference between the film and the book, and that Stephen King, I believe, who is, I think, one of the maybe the greatest American writer of all time, I think gets discounted quite a bit because his books are so horrific and rely on things supernatural. And the fact of the matter is he's a brilliant writer. He writes brilliant characters. And I think there is a fear inside him, although you'd have to ask him, that if he doesn't supply those kinds of horrific moments to his audience, they will be upset with him, much like the way Annie Wilkes is in this movie. And I think this is why this movie is in this book of his is so important to him, because he's frightened that his fans will desert him if he doesn't give them what they want. And I felt that an artist, you know, does not have to continue to do that, but can move on to other things. And so we had the actual book of Misery's Return be burned and lost forever, and so that it could free Paul Sheldon to moving on to other kinds of writing.
I'll be seeing you in all.
And then, of course, we close with Liberace singing, and the whole Liberace motif, I think, is really wonderful in this movie.
Embraces all day through.
And looking at credits, I mean, which nobody who watches this will ever do, but for me, it's like home movies, because I see names of people that I've worked with and still work with, and some people that I don't no longer work with, but have great fond feelings for. And it's nice to look at these names because it reminds you of the time that you had making the movie and the experience.
I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day. I'll be seeing you in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.